This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike. Before we dive into a great reference show on insurance fintech, I wanted to share with you an exciting one-off announcement. Some time ago, I set up a PayPal link for those of you listeners who felt like donating to the podcast. I'm very grateful to all of you who did so. For those of you who didn't, the window is now closed, so if you like the podcast, you'll have to buy me a beer when we get the chance to meet. As of this episode, I'm delighted to announce that I now have three brand partners for the show who will relieve you all of the need to fret over my poor starving children and the long-term health of the project. I'm also indebted to Charlie Barker, FinTech CTO extraordinaire, for suggesting, or rather telling me, towards the end of last year that the show really needed sponsorship to take it to the next level. I resolved to do so when the show passed 50 episodes and 100,000 downloads. So here we now are, albeit 140,000 downloads in 140 countries, and henceforth the podcast will be co-branded. As you may have noticed, virtually every sporting and artistic event of any stature these days is co-branded. Co-branded being where one party creates an asset, be it the FA Cup or the Royal Opera House performances, and the other party shares the kudos and helps with the funding. In alphabetical order, Arch Ever set the ball rolling, and I'm particularly indebted to their CEO, Angus Dent, who was on the show in LFP029, who suggested to me that there were benefits in having a consortium of partners rather than just one. My face fell when he told me this, as my workload in lining this up instantly more than tripled, along with the necessity to herd cats. However, time has proved him correct, and this kind of creativity is something I associate with Archiver, who tend to do larger, more complex deals, and who I know from the inside out, having consulted with them last year. Smart Pension, I'm delighted to welcome into the fold. They are on the show as recently as LFP059. I noticed when editing that show that I said wow about half a dozen times. Having started in FS, raised £100 million for charity in his spare time, and sold millions of stems of flowers is an amazing achievement. But obviously a greater challenge was called for, and Will and Chums entered the fintech arena and got 75,000 clients in less than 2 years. I popped back there recently and found that they now have 100,000 clients. Phenomenal. The final piece of the jigsaw fell into place when I was wondering if I'd ever come across a firm with a better track record. I was delighted when Synchron, about whom at the time I knew very little, came my way via a long-standing city chum Tony, who now heads their consultancy practice. Founded in 2001 by some ex-Merrill's folks, they have grown in 15 years without any external capital, from a startup to a firm employing 6,000 people in 16 countries worldwide with $400 million revenue per annum. Even more phenomenal. So, with the new co-branding firmly in place, the podcast launches itself into a new era with a great show about insurtech. Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 61, brought to you in association with Archiever, Smart Pension, and Synchron. I'm delighted to be joined today by Jonathan Howe, UK Insurance Lead at PricewaterhouseCoopers. As long-time listeners will know, I'm very reluctant to give anyone a big-picture topic on anything. Most folks are experts at various coal faces, and very few are experts on the whole coal mine. However, Jonathan is a rara avis in the modern world in many ways. His LinkedIn career is perhaps the shortest I have read. One entry, 23 years at PwC. Now that's the lifetime employment model that used to exist back in the day and exists for very few today. That's also, compared to many butterflies in the modern world, an opportunity to dig a very deep well of experience and knowledge in a sector. Secondly, Jonathan leads the UK insurance practice, which amounts to over 1,000 people in London, and is responsible for PwC's services for the insurance industry across all their range, including audit, regulatory compliance, actuarial, consulting, tax, and deals. Thirdly, PwC have been involved in a series of reports on the sector. Now, there are plenty of reports out there, the more cynical amongst you may say, and quality varies. This is true. However, in InsurTech, A Force for Good, I'll include a link in the show notes, Jonathan and its partners in the report, Startup Bootcamp, of which Nectarios was on LFP013 some time ago, have gone more than an extra mile. Amazingly, they have surveyed over 1,300 insurance startups. Wow, didn't even know that number exist. I would have had a hard time thinking of 13. Add that to decades in the industry, and we have someone who really is an expert. So I'm looking forward to Jonathan wielding his swords of truth and wisdom, or failing that, just talking, and filling us in about InsurTech. This sector has been massively hyped over the last year, but dozy folks like me haven't seen much action yet. So I look forward to hosting a real learning session. I met Jonathan at an event recently. It wasn't a game of top trumps, but if it had been, Jonathan would have won hands down. When you have a database of 1,300 startups, that's a hell of a lot of facts to bring into any debate. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And so before we dive into 1,300 stories of fintech, for some reason when we were having a coffee the other day, you mentioned Vespers, about which I know very little, other than I was planning a holiday in Vietnam. And one of the things I'd seen some time ago was Top Gear Visit Vietnam, where the three guys had to buy motorbikes in Ho Chi Minh City and then travel the length of Vietnam. And Jeremy Clarkson, who hates motorbikes and can't ride, ended up with a Vespa with a dodgy wheel, which turned out to be a bit of a nightmare to go the whole length of a thousands of long miles long country, as there are potholes all over the place, and roughly the Vespa seemed to sort of fall into about half of them. So what is your abiding interest in Vespas? And what is a Vespa for those people who may not know what a Vespa is, actually? So
it's the Italian scooter, and actually probably the interest is really in the more classic. So I have one from early 70s, I have one in the 80s, and I have a more modern one. I think it's fair to say, you said Jeremy's had a dodgy wheel. I think most Vespas have a dodgy something. It's one of the things that attracts you to them. You can get to play with them. It's like when I was younger and you had a car, you could tinker with the engine. I can tinker with the Vespa.
You look far too young to have been a sort of mod on the streets of Brighton in the 1960s, which I think was sort of one of the Vespas' heyday in the UK, wasn't it?
And they're still there. You can still go to festivals. There'll be thousands of scooters there. We have thousands of mods will still be there and other groups. There's still that culture. I've never been a mod. To be honest, I just enjoy riding them. They're great fun, even though I have to put up with as many potholes in England as Jeremy did in Vietnam.
Right. We went to the MotoGP, which is, for those that don't know, the Formula One equivalent for motorbikes in Catalonia, a little wine back outside Barcelona. And those bikes go phenomenally fast. I mean, it was literally a phenomenon in the literal sense, like being out on an ocean or being in a big sand desert, seeing these bikes go so fast. And off the top of my head, they seem to ride something around the paddock when they're not riding their big bikes, which look remarkably like modern Vespas, actually. Are they still Vespas?
They ride the modern scooters. But there are Vespas. There are modern Vespas. Like, you see loads of them in London around now.
So is Vespa still going as a company then? Who's it owned by?
It's Piaggio. But it's great fun. But they also race Vespas. It's not quite the same, but doing 90 mile an hour on 10-inch wheels...
Gosh.
...could still be fun.
I never imagined they went that fast.
Mine don't.
I hope your employer has got some good insurance for your family when you wipe yourself out at 90 miles an hour without airbags in your suits. So goodness knows how I'm going to connect Vespas to InsurTech, and I think it's such a leap that I won't even bother, actually. So we'll just sort of try and sort of cough and sound like there was an edit point and I'd miss something out. So moving on swiftly from Vespas, how come you've ended up in sort of this insurance tech world? I mean, as I mentioned, you're one of these sort of folks who did pretty much what I was told would happen when I was at school, that all you boys were going to go out and get a job and you find a nice, you know, get a good degree and you find a nice company and then you work there for life and you retire on these things like final salary pension schemes and it's all a bit wonderful and that kind of thing. So how did it work for you then? Do you get assigned as a new graduate to, you know, insurance, or do you sort of get told how to account for things?
Yeah, so I mean, for me, I left university, I joined PwC and I qualified as a chartered accountant. And actually at the time I specialised in tax. But from day one, I worked within the insurance industry. And although I've been with PwC for 23 years, it's been quite a varied career. I've played lots of different roles within the firm and actually out in-house as well on secondment, but always within insurance. And you can look at the job of a consultant in many ways, you're an advisor, but fundamentally, to me, you have to understand your clients, you have to understand the industry. You look for opportunities, obviously, for the industry and for yourselves, and you look for the problems. And you know, we can talk about it in much more detail, but over the last, you know, probably 18, 24 months ago, you really started to see that new technologies and the way they're being employed and the price of them was such, they could actually solve some of the problems that the insurance industry had been struggling with for many years.
Yes, so going back to the sort of 23 years, I mean, for those people who aren't in the city or aren't actually in FS, the city really is a kind of collection of tribes, and quite often there isn't much interaction between tribes. So, you know, I started in the mid-80s, and in those days, it would be quite rare for a banker, well, it'd be very rare. I mean, I never heard of a merchant banker going to a commercial bank, for example. They'd never do that kind of thing. So that's like kind of tribes within the banks. But it would be very rare for a banker to move into insurance, or vice versa, for an insurance person to move into banking. And I'm sure there's more movement these days and narrowing down, but they still are kind of, in a way, very different businesses. I mean, insurance and banking are very different businesses, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And you can start really at the kind of the very basic way. If you're talking banking, you always talk about your assets. You're talking insurance, you always talk about your managing your liabilities. And certainly when people talk, for example, about the financial crisis and the impact that had on FS, very different impacts on insurers. Generally, they stood up well, they were robust, they didn't have problems paying claims. It's changed the industry since, but they are very different.
With the exception of that one that's completely slipped my mind, I mean, you're talking about assets and liabilities, that vast American, I've forgotten, it slipped my mind.
I think you're talking about AIG.
AIG, yes, I need to begin with A and it's got a G in it. We'll come on to blockchain and parties later, but I'm suffering from a blockchain party. Yes, AIG, whose assets became liabilities, and unfortunately they were in dire straits in the States and one of the ones that was sort of bailed out. But as you say, insurance pretty much sailed through that in a way that FS didn't. Although talking about London, one of the things that's very special about insurance in London is the Lloyd's insurance market. Mm-hmm. And there was some anniversary, I noticed recently, of their mega crisis when basically the whole thing went bust and the whole structure was changed and all this kind of thing. And amazingly, Phoenix-like, it has literally risen from the ashes and is incredibly strong and still leading the world at the moment. So in terms of your couple of decades in insurance, what have been the sort of the big standout things for you before we get on to, as you say, the last 18 to 24 months, things start changing? I mean, from the outside, other than having read about the sort of the Lloyd's crisis, you know, car premium rates go up and down and house rates change and all that kind of stuff. But this is a sort of an ex-banker's prejudice, of course. Otherwise, insurance doesn't really change. It just carries on insuring people. Of course, that's from a distance.
I mean, there's been some big changes. So if I think about it, in the 80s and then particularly in the 90s, we had a real change in sources of capital. So you had the rise of Bermuda and capital going to Bermuda, and that was actually really associated with Lloyd's reinventing itself and strengthening that. And that was a huge change. In the early 2000s, you had the change in direct writers in retail insurance, people like Direct Line coming into the market. You had groups like Admiral coming in. That changed how quickly Direct Line got such a large portion of the market, just by the idea of being able to buy using a phone. And I think more recently, comparison websites, you know, the huge percentage of motor insurance is actually bought by people who go onto a comparison website. And that's been a really radical change in distribution.
Yes, it's interesting, starting with the first one about the introduction of institutional capital and all that, and having said that simplistically, the banking and insurance are different. They do actually overlap in some areas. So when I was running fixed interest fund management, we had a large chunk of captive insurance companies, mostly in the Channel Islands, but actually one of my clients, I was very pleased to say, was in Bermuda, not least of which because I could stay at the Southampton Princess, which happens to have its own par 3 golf course overlooking the ocean, which was rather sort of a fantastic gig to have to go and report to them on their investment performance. But going back to the sort of fintech stuff, of course, we had a lot of peer-to-peers set up on the idea that it was peer-to-peer, that it was person-to-person, and originally going back to the roots of insurance, it was, you know, Swiss farmers getting together, as John Kay has spoken about on the show, to insure their cows. So it literally was a very, very P2P thing. And then, of course, institutional capital comes in. So moving on to your report, and just a very sort of simple question. I mean, the people I happen to have mentioned that I'm talking to you about this subject today, they've all had exactly the same reaction as me, which is 1,300 insurance startups. I didn't know there were 13. So,
and yeah, that's right. And it does depend what we mean by an insurance startup. It's really hard to get a foothold or get into this ecosystem and actually see what's out there. And this was something I found when about 18 months ago I really started looking at this. And of course, one way to get into this ecosystem, particularly if you're sitting out in the corporate mainstream, is to partner up. And one of the first things we did was partner with Startup Bootcamp, which is an accelerator program. They got fantastic contacts and they were running an InsurTech program. So when we partnered with them, they were just going through the process of getting out of the market and finding out what's insurance. So the credit for finding those startups must lie with that team.
I thought I hadn't seen Nectarus for a while. He must have been going
all
around
Europe.
He's been
really, really busy. Really. Since then, of course, I'm working here. We've seen lots more and I probably get, I think, probably 2 to 3 inquiries a week from new startups. If you add it up, that's a lot as well. But these are businesses. And the other thing is, they're businesses that could be really at the start of their journey. These could be before the first round of seed capital. So usually when people talk about startups, they're talking about ones that have some customers, have some money. We talk to those, but we also talk to people who said, I've got a great idea and I want to use it in insurance. Or people went, I've got a great idea, could I pivot it to insurance? Or also when we went, you've got a great idea, have you ever thought about using it in insurance? Which gives you that really big pull. And the real aim was to find out what is the art of the possible in technology now in the insurance industry, and let's cast our net wide.
Yes, it's interesting. I was just looking at the report here. I think it's worth reading out the first paragraph of the executive summary. And as I say, I really commend people's attention to it. It's very readable, nicely presented. And frankly, if you read this, you will know more than about 99.99% of people in fintech that talk about insurance technology. The executive summary of your report says, insurance technology, insurtech, is a burgeoning phenomenon that has the potential to help the insurance industry reconnect with its customers following a period of increased alienation and disengagement. Not only does insurtech offer the insurance industry huge commercial potential, it can also help insurers reaffirm their purpose in society to protect and support policyholders. And then you mentioned interesting statistics like only 27% of consumers trust their insurance providers. And when I've spoken to insurers before on the show, they're painfully aware of this. And what I haven't actually seen is the opposite statistic, which is what percentage of their customers do insurers trust? Because, of course, one of the problems in insurance is that if I set up an insurance company tomorrow, you know, surprise, surprise, someone might lie to me and actually be claiming rather more than is the case. So I think the one thing needs to be added is there is a two-way process going on here, which some kind of insurtechs try and disrupt. But it came back to the alienation and disengagement, I mean, because, of course, that's a phenomenon we see on the banking side, that many people actually actively dislike their banks. I mean, without mentioning the name, I dislike my bank that I use for my own little company myself for a whole bunch of sort of trivial reasons, but I just find it really annoying. I just like to eliminate it tomorrow. So I'm hoping one of these app-only banks actually does something and starts being nice, and I'll hop over there. So what you're pointing at here is that, you know, a number of the customers of insurance incumbents are actually not particularly satisfied. The problem, and why I'd always understood insurtech as not being such a big phenomenon as you might read from LinkedIn and other sort of stuff like that, is that unlike in other areas of fintech, if I go off and set an insurtech up tomorrow and say, I'm going to be a nice company, I'm going to insure you and all that kind of thing, before you know it, the far bigger net of the insurance regulator comes along and says, great, Mike. Ah, now, by the way, you're not an insurtech company, you're an insurance company. And, you know, you could do with £1 billion of capital, and insurance companies work much better with about 10,000 clients and all that kind of stuff. So that actually, in a way, it's really very hard being an alternative to the insurance industry, because by definition, that becomes an insurance company. And by definition, you're then in the industry. So how do you think that dynamic varies in insurance compared to, as I say, in banking, where you can set up at your own bank tomorrow, if you like?
Yeah. It's a really good point, and it comes up a lot when people talk about disruption of the industry, because often people jump to, well, the industry is going to be disrupted, that means the incumbents won't be there in 5 years and we have a whole bunch of new insurers. Let me be clear, I do not think that will happen. There are very few startups coming into the industry wanting to be an insurance company. There are very few coming in and saying, I want to put at risk tens, hundreds of millions of capital.
Yeah, and I can insure people for a tenth of the price of those sort of robber barons.
We're not there. So what we're saying is, if we look at the value chain, all the different activities of an insurer, from writing products to having the capital, all the way through to distribution and engagement, can InsurTech help do any of those areas better? You know, we have to step back. Insurance is very rarely going to be something you're excited about buying, you're really happy. Your general engagement is, once a year you pay a premium if it's retail. You probably don't like doing that either, because you probably then had to phone up and go through some sort of bartering on the phone for your car insurance to bring it down to a reasonable price. And then, of course, you only claim when something bad's happened. So even if someone deals with it really well, you're still not in the best of frame. You've written off your car. So that's always difficult, and that's going to be difficult to the banking sector, etc. But can you increase that engagement? Can you actually make it easier for a customer? Can you engage your customer on their terms, not yours? So if they want to deal by a mobile app, if they want to follow the claims process electronically and see where it is without having to phone up. So you're picking different parts of that value chain and specialising in that. And that's what we're seeing from InsurTop, not let's set up a new insurance company and put capital.
Yeah, well, it's a very good contextualisation, and it's important that listeners get that, because if you don't get that, then every time you have a conversation, you get stuck on the, but hang on, you can't be a new insurance company without being an insurance company. Just thinking before we get into the sort of the flow of the value chain and the process, as you put it, one of the things in the modern world is about information and data and how this can be handled better and all this kind of stuff in, say, like claims process. But I went to a one-day thing, I think in 2014, I think it was with Aviva, on insurance and that, and there were quite a few people from Aviva on the table that I was on in one of the working groups. And one of the simple points that I was making, and I haven't actually tripped across a startup that necessarily does this, and of course, everyone around the table, a lot of them were working for Aviva, but also as individuals, they buy insurance themselves. So they're producers and consumers. And the general problem we all have wearing our consumer hat, even if you're the chairman of an insurance company, you're a consumer as well, is knowing what the bloody hell I'm covered for. You know, for all I know, my phone might be covered three times on different policies or not at all covered, you know. And so literally just some sort of app that I just give my insurance policy numbers to, and it sort of says, oh, do you know what, your phone's covered 15 times, but your car isn't actually, or equivalent. And that would just be really useful, just manage the information. And again, I don't blame the companies because the regulator requires it. You know, if you read through all the terms and conditions, you've got these 48 pages. I'm going on holiday. You know, you read the first big picture things and then there's pages and pages and you just...
You're absolutely right. And, you know, if you were cynical, you'd say a historic model of insurance was you bought insurance in silos and that meant you either overinsured individual things. As you said, your phone insurance might well be covered four or five times or not at all, or you fall in the gap. So when you make a claim, there's either, you know, you could either claim more two or three times so someone else can bear the cost, or you fall in the gap. And actually what we're starting to see, and this is where some of the new technologies and new approaches are really interesting, not just all startups, also companies in-house doing this, is you see three approaches to that. One of which you're seeing some companies starting to say, you can give us your policies, we can scan them, use artificial intelligence actually to find the gaps and tell you where you've got crossover. You've got a second one saying, actually, we can start to develop policies that just insure you. Right? We say we cover everything you've got in this space. And actually, you know, one day maybe we'll cover your house and your car and your lifestyle in one policy because we know you.
Which is inverting the model from insuring objects like my phone, my roof, my car, to insuring the individual what owns them all.
That's right. And the third model, though, is going the opposite way, is very much kind of a micro insurance specific, which is actually I want to insure certain items. It's often your gadgets and your sporting equipment. I want my bike, I want my phone, everything else actually I'm kind of comfortable, I'm more or less there. And we're seeing all three of those to deal with that problem.
Interesting. So picking up this point about startups before we move on to incumbents and the interaction between them and then the future, where are you seeing the startups that are really active, getting traction, bringing really interesting ideas to the party?
Yeah, so it's a relatively immature market, insurance startups. So what we have seen to date, I think about 80%, I would say, were front-end customer facing. And I think you can explain that by people saying, as many of the startups I talk to, I tried to buy insurance or I made a claim. It was a terrible experience. I could do better. I've got some ideas to deal with that. And that's driving it. There's much less of people saying, I have a 20 or 30 years of insurance experience. I've got an idea to take the cost base out, to improve efficiency in the back office flows, to help underwriting our claims. So very much customer facing at the moment. If you swap into what we see in banking, it's probably 75-80% would be back office process focused. So very different. I suspect over this year and next year, as we start to see people come in, I'll see much more focus coming through to that back office as well.
And in terms of the purchasing of insurance, going back to the comparison sites, and I think I've got to roll over my house insurance at the moment or something like that. Of course, there were these price comparison sites, and that's a whole sort of thing in its own world in terms of being a bit of a scam and how they're getting sort of commissions here and there, and the whole thing's a little bit of a cheat, which I don't know much about, but I know there's an area. But I wasn't so much thinking of that. I was more thinking of the problem that at the moment, we as consumers tend to buy insurance basically on price. So for the sake of argument, I keep rolling it over the same company. Then after a while, I assume they're just sort of ripping me off a bit. So I bother to check after a few years and I get a list of for the lowest price, the highest price. And basically my algorithm is I scan down it until it's a name I recognise. Because I assume that the, you know, Liverpool, Victoria, whoever it is actually, oh, they're a reasonable company. They're going to sort of be okay. But you can compare that to, I don't know, Checkatrade or Amazon or something, whether there's ratings where you're buying not just on price, but on quality. So, for example, I won't use any insurers' names. Let's say insurer A gets 3 stars out of 5 on Trustpilot on paying claims. You know? And insurer B gets 4.5 stars. Well, other things being equal, actually, I'd quite like to know the quality of how people rate them on their claims payments, as well as the price. You know, when I'm going down this table, rather than, oh, I recognise that logo, they must be okay.
Some incumbent insurers now are publishing claims details, how much they pay, how quickly they pay, and customer satisfaction, and at least one of the major ones prints all the customer feedback verbatim, as long as inflammatory, but so you can see it. I think one of the problems is what do you compete against other than price, particularly when products are really complicated? And for insurers, that's a really difficult market. So if they can start using something else to compete against, either by being able to make it clear to people what the differentiating factors are, or to say it's convenient. So the idea, you know, one I've seen recently, you want a quote, all you do, take a photograph of your driving license, photograph of the number plate, and they would come back to you. They've got 90% of the information they need to do the quote. That sort of convenience, you say, wow, actually.
Yeah, I have some of that.
And you start to compete on something else. You also take the cost base out of the insurer, which allows you to compete further on price because you can put price down without hitting margins.
Excellent. Right. Well, those are sort of interesting ideas, and I can see why it would change the experience. And I can also see in terms of this sort of front-end loading of how the startup insurtech market is structured at the moment, that it really is just following on from this whole sort of consumer empowerment that comes from having a phone in your pocket. And for the sake of argument, looking at restaurants in London and finding that Google can give you restaurants, and Google tells you not only what the price in the restaurant, but how many star ratings people have given it. Although I always found there's a bit of a problem with that, because you can end up with some rubbish chip shop getting 5 stars, and also you can end up with the Ritz getting 5 stars.
They're very good chips.
Very good chips, yes. So how are the incumbents viewing this sort of insurtech at the moment? As you say, they're kind of more open-minded, but one of the problems is you say, oh, let's go and do something, and then you get a million people knocking on your door. So Ben from Aviva Ventures was on the show a few months ago talking about this, and one of the challenges that they have and Startup Bootcamp have and yourselves have is filtering. You know, if you put your sign outside the door, we're a big insurance company, we've got lots of money to spend, we think insurtech's really important. Before you know, you've got 1,300 people queuing up outside, which is too many suitors to choose from, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So a few thoughts on that. Firstly, insurers, you know, definitely do get the idea that technology is going to transform their business if they can afford it. How they go about dealing with it is quite different. So traditionally, you say, well, okay, if you're an insurer, there's a problem. I work out what the problem is. In-house, I will now try to fix it. Or I might pay a technology company to come in and help me fix it. That's quite different to saying, how do they feel about the insurtech startup community? I think a large number of insurers still have to be convinced there's value there. And I think a number are really quite cynical about the impact they will have.
When we met at a meeting, which were nameless, there were some very old hands in insurance, one or two of whom looked like they retired a long time ago, who were very sort of bah humbug, this will never happen, this can't possibly happen. And I rather liked your replies, well, maybe, but actually, and then you named sort of several insurance startups that are doing it already.
The point is, you start on that conversation where someone says, bah humbug, we've been around for 300 years and it's basically the same companies and they'll still be here in 10 years' time because no one wants to take our capital. And I think that's right. But will parts, profitable parts of your value chain start to be taken away and disrupted? Will someone come in and distribute better than you do at a lower cost? How will that impact your business? Will someone come in and help use data to better underwrite and your competitors use it and you don't? That's when you're disrupted. So, as again, most of the startups I talk to do not really consider themselves disruptors. They consider themselves enhancers. They say there's a problem, we can work insurers to fix it. It becomes disruptive if it's done to the insurers. If the insurers manage it and work with it, it's enhancing.
I like this enhancers word. I haven't heard that before, actually. And we're all, anybody's anywhere near fintech, very bored of the disruption word. It's become such a cliche, you can sort of really deconstruct it. You know, it's not that obvious how much is really being disrupted as a whole across fintech at the moment. And the point I often make is that if the whole of fintech disappeared tonight, nobody would actually be really missing it tomorrow, nor would it be a macroeconomic importance whatsoever in terms of GNP. And at the moment, you know, the likes of a JP Morgan or a Citigroup would probably buy every so-called disruptive fintech player in London without actually worrying about the capital front. However, the enhancement is a very interesting thing. And I think that, you know, the point that springs to mind listening to you talk about that, Jonathan, is that even if there are no startups who are doing sort of standalone stuff in the way that, for example, bought by many, Stephen Mundell was on the show last year, even if none of those are existing in 5 years, the name of the game for incumbents will have changed, and there will be competitive gains and losses amongst the incumbents, depending on how well they adapt to this new technologies coming their way and the people who are going to try and help them along the journey.
Yeah, so you said, you know, how do you filter? The starting point is, as an insurer, what is the problem I'm trying to fix? And you get to that stage where if I can do this, or I can do that, or I can do other better, then we can really change our business. And actually, historically, you've asked that question. You've asked it to yourself. You've asked it to consultants like ourselves, actually. Now, actually, you can ask a question, and I can turn around and say, do you know what? There's 10 or 12 or 3 or 4 startups out there who are developing something in that area. You should talk to them. Maybe you can partner them. Maybe you can business partner. So it's another way of solving the problems, which is why I say it's all about enhancing your business. It's fixing your problems. It's not disruption, unless you let it pass you by.
Yes, and this seems to be the kind of mature model that the industry is reaching across all the segments, which is that almost by definition, large players, whether large insurance companies or large banks, need large corporate partners in doing something, whether it's audit or whether it's technology or any of these lines that you guys do. And then you've got the situation that the large players, whether the PwCs or Accentures or anything like that, with the kind of size, scale and cost base, they can't really economically work with these tiny startups that have got no revenue and no capital whatsoever, because you know you're not a charity. However, when there's a case that it's transforming an industry like this, I can see very well that you know you guys can devote, as you do, a chunk of your time almost on a kind of pro bono basis, getting to know the marketplace, getting to know the players and all that kind of stuff, and then monetize it insofar as your incumbents and your clients actually needing this kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, we do work with startups and we do help them raise money, etc. But, you know, these are very small businesses looking to grow. And to some extent, you know, they're always cash poor. And you work with them and some will grow and that's great. And hopefully we'll build up a relationship and trust and we'll still work with them. But clearly, a big need of this is helping the incumbents work with startups. There's huge issues. There's issues, the cultural issues are massive. So, you know, when a startup meets a big insurer and they have a good conversation, the insurer says, that's great, we'll take it back to your office and we'll get back to you shortly. The startup will look at their watch and say, well, tomorrow morning, you know, and the insurer saying, well, we've got a few meetings. I was thinking 8 weeks. And to be honest, we're pretty proud of ourselves. We can turn it around in 8 weeks. And you've seen examples. I think this is why often acquisitions don't work. You see a company with 100,000 people worldwide buy a startup of 20. Now, quite quickly, to be fair, it's kind of the equivalent of taking them into a back alley and beating them with a baseball bat, right? You're going to kill it really quick, which is why I like the partnering. You also have all the issues around taking the startup's technology and integrating it into a large insurer. And you also, of course, it's not just plugging in the technology. You've got to change the way you work. You've got to change the way you use that technology. You've got to change the way you think. And all of those are big change challenges. So I suppose, you know, that's where people help.
Absolutely. It's very clear. So as always, time's shooting on. And as I say, it's a nice report. It's not too thick. So I do recommend that people check it out and they can learn quite a lot. And I've never practiced this before because it's the first time I'm doing it. But before we wrap up, I'd like to thank my brand partners on the podcast today who ensure that I no longer have to pay my own bus ticket and I can probably buy a cup of tea on the way home, if not a biscuit. So I'd like to thank Archrover, smart, simple and transparent P2P business lending, 100,000 to £3 million loans for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Synchron, digital, business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 6,000 people, 16 countries and $400 million in revenues. So having thanked them for paying for the batteries, actually they're not paying for the batteries because I've plugged it into your electricity, I've got a new charger. We can get on to the bit where you're allowed to get your flags out and wave them shamelessly in terms of the other things that you're doing, PwC and insurance and, you know, interesting stuff and what you're looking for more of, what you offer. And you also did mention blockchain, so I managed to sort of hold you back on blockchain till now, but I'm much more favourably disposed to blockchain than I was sort of yesterday, not least of which was these lovely drinks at the Tate Modern. That's another story entirely.
Yes, thank you for that. And, well, if you like this report, and you start off thinking that insurtech's overhyped, and we tried to debunk that myth a bit about saying what's really going on. I then thought we should tackle an even more hyped sector, which is blockchain. So in conjunction with ZEN, we've produced a report on blockchain and its potential uses in the commercial sector. And as part of that, again, it's based on over 50 insurers took part in that research. And as part of that, we actually built here in our offices, actually in our Belfast office, we have a blockchain team. We build blockchains. So we build a proof of concept around the insurance market. Actually saying blockchain doesn't solve the world's ills, but actually if I look at the insurance sector, what processes, what procedures, what do we do where it could make a difference? And we analyse that and actually identify two or three areas where we can make a real difference. So if you want to kind of go back to original research based on what the industry wants, that's a report on blockchain that's out there from us.
Yes, and as I say, I went to this thing last night by Synchron. And the one thing that's interesting me in the third quarter of 2016, which certainly wasn't the case a year ago, or wasn't even the case in the first quarter, as far as I noticed, is that now you've got serious grown-ups who understand the business and they're coming at from a business perspective and seeing how you can apply technology, as opposed to, certainly in terms of the propaganda a year ago, you get technologists and IT who say, oh, it'll solve everything. But actually, they don't understand, for example, the nuances of the insurance market.
Yeah.
So it really has flipped around, which is, I think, is what's making it interesting. And then, you know, some of the things that are coming out of it, I mean, it's another time for another show, but some of the things that are coming out of it is that, of course, there's a lot of the cultural dynamics around this, which is, it's fine having a technology like blockchain, blah, 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 and doing stuff. But there needs to be the desire, if you've got a private blockchain between, say, a bunch of insurers or something like that, there needs to be the desire for companies to cooperate very closely who may not have cooperated closely before. So very cultural rather than tech.
Although that's why I get excited by insurance, because if you look at the London market and Lloyd's in particular, they work in that marketplace sharing every single day. So it feels particularly suited for that.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not so sure. I don't know. I mean, maybe they do, but maybe insurers collaborate on things like car insurance or whatever. Maybe they've got some sort of blacklist of people who keep claiming all the time.
It's probably more between the consumer, the insurer, the repair shops and solicitors. It'd be sharing in that chain, I think, you might well see in the retail space.
Right, okay, so that's the blockchain stuff. I'll include a link in the show notes. Are there any more flags you've got to wave?
My PwC flag. So my team, as you mentioned already, over 1,000 people who actually just specialise in the insurance sector. So I feel we know the insurance sector fantastically well. And what we've been doing over the last 18 months, and before that actually wider in fintech, we know that fintech startup sector fantastically well as well. So if you need to understand what's going on out there, what's real, who's looking at what startups are in what area, and actually how other people have tackled this and made it work and integrate, I think we have a really strong credentials and expertise around that.
Absolutely, and certainly as sort of, well, I was about to say grown up, I'm not a grown up, but I'm just sort of older than I used to be. But as somebody who's been around sort of FS for a while, I've always been very sceptical of the narratives. Certainly one heard in 2014 about all these sort of boring incumbents who really sort of don't understand anything, about to be disrupted overnight. And funny enough, a lot of the people who sort of came out with those kind of claims have actually moved on from the sector, not unsurprisingly, because anybody who's been an incumbent of any sort for a decade or two or three in the city will understand that actually it's rather more complex than it looks, and all the embedded knowledge is there. It's always been changing, as you referred to before, and the significant changes going on at the moment. So again, without telling tales out of school, I was very happy to introduce PwC last year to a client that I was doing some work with, because what firms like yours can provide is extremely unique and extremely valuable in the right circumstances. So I think it's, you know, much more of a 2016 narrative, which is that there are all these various players. Nobody's stupid, or if they are stupid, they ain't going to last very long. And really, the interesting thing is how we all sort of rearrange this sort of 15-dimensional jigsaw puzzle of all these things that are happening at the moment, and how we sort of surf the wave of change in the industry. So that's been extremely helpful, Jonathan. Time's gone by very quickly, and I wish you great success in straddling this exciting world of change, incumbents, startups, and your 1,300 new friends that you and Nectarius have found. That's a long Christmas card list, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.